Thank you. It seems like yesterday that I was a young theosophist, and it was actually the late 70s, Tim, but thank you for that, you know, decade. I am so glad to be here, and I know you guys came out in this weather, but I was so delighted to see it snowing. I have been out walking in it. I've been taking pictures. It is wonderful because when I left home this morning, I know this will make you jealous, but probably, it was 70 degrees. And I forgot my coat. I picked my purse up off my coat and just walked out the door because it never crossed my mind. Fortunately, my car, I live out of my car, so I had warm items in the car to bring with me. One thing Tim didn't mention, of course, I don't know if Tim even knows, but I'm a grandmother now. And that is the best. Thank you. It is the best. It is absolutely the best. So, you know, she may be astrally listening to her first theosophical lecture tonight if her parents got her to sleep on time. You know, when we look around the world today, we see so much sadness, so many difficulties, so much suffering. We can become overwhelmed pretty quickly because of that. We look around and we see poverty and hunger. We see intolerance, discrimination, inequality. We see violence seems to be the primary means of solving conflict or just acting out. Around the world, we face the scourge of substance abuse and the difficulties that substance abuse places, the suffering on its users and the loved ones of those users. So as we look around the world today, we might almost want to give up in despair and say, as the master said, oh, this orphan humanity. As theosophists through the years, we've been reproached for hiding in our books, of not living in the real world. We're faulted for being head-focused and not heart-focused. We've been accused of, and probably a few people have, insulated ourselves from the suffering of humanity, possibly thinking that individually we can't even begin to help this incredible amount of suffering. So we return to our studies, safe in the understanding that suffering is just part of life, isn't it? It's just part of life. It's just the way it is. I mean, it is the Kali Yuga, right? Well, no. It is the Kali Yuga, according to what I've read. But we don't get to just insulate ourselves. Theosophy is the study of the ancient wisdom. We all know that. The ancient wisdom which prompts us to strive for conscious awareness, self-conscious awareness of our own divinity and the unity of all beings. Theosophy is about wholeness. If one of us falls into the mire, then we all fall into the mire. If one of us suffers, we all suffer. We can't separate into head or heart. Both head and heart are part of who we are. Both are needed for successful functioning in this world. Think for a moment. What would it be like to live with a mind alone and no heart? What would it be like to live with a heart and no mind? We need both. We have both, and we have to use both. Of course, we're all familiar with the three objects of the society, the objects which are the basis of the commonality that we find in the society. Members, as you know, and I'm speaking to, you know, to the choir here, are not required to accept a particular set of beliefs or engage in a particular set of practices. Where we find commonality is in being in sympathy with the three objects. So we are unique and individual in our beliefs, except for that common sympathy. The objects are to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity, without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color. To encourage the study of comparative religion, philosophy, and science, and to investigate the unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent in humanity. In more modern language, sort of what Tim did, we might say that the Theosophical Society is dedicated to promoting the unity of all beings, to fostering religious and racial, multicultural understanding by studying comparative religion, philosophy, and science, and to further discovery, or to further the discovery, of the spiritual aspect of life and human beings. Rohit Mehta, a former International Secretary of the Theosophical Society and a prolific writer, says, "The three objects of the Theosophical Society form one integrated whole. They cannot, therefore, be considered in isolation, separated one from the other. It is when we do so that we wrongly evaluate the work of the Theosophical Society. Together, the three objects indicate what may be called the Theosophical approach to life. The Theosophical Society stands preeminently for brotherhood, and brotherhood implies right perception of things objective. How to come to this right perception? It is this which is indicated under the study of comparative religion, philosophy, and science, and under the search for unexplained laws of nature and the powers latent in man." A disclaimer. We're all very familiar with theosophical literature. Much of theosophical literature was written perhaps before we were a little bit, before we were as gender enlightened as we are today. So while the literature talks about brotherhood and man, it means all of us. I think we know that. But I don't want anybody to be offended and think that we're not all-inclusive. Mehta further talks about the word investigate and says that it means to carry on a careful search. He distinguishes the word investigate in the third object from the word study in the second object. He tells us that when we address the second object and study comparative religion, philosophy, and science, that we are expanding the mind. He goes further and states that the third object deals with transcending the mind. He points out that psychic abilities such as clairvoyance and clairaudience are simply extensions of the physical senses, and that studying these issues do not bring us any closer to understanding the mystery of life. He writes that unexplained really means unperceived, and that the powers latent in humanity must mean a new dimension of consciousness, a consciousness that transcends the limitations of the mind. And then he questions our ability to explore something that is beyond the mind. How can the mind know what lies beyond it? He states that it's only when the mind becomes quiet that we can begin to comprehend what is beyond it. He writes, "It is when the mind becomes a perfect reflecting medium that new facets of the human personality can be discovered. And in the discovery of these new facets of the human personality, there takes place also the discovery of unexplained laws of nature. Thus, the powers latent in humanity and unexplained laws of nature are interrelated. Or to put it differently, the discovery of the one naturally leads to the discovery of the other." While there's a great deal in his comments that could keep us talking for quite a while, one concept stands out. We must study, investigate, and reflect. Study, action, meditation. It is through study, action, and meditation that we will expand the mind, transcend the mind, and move closer to understanding the mystery of life. Studying allows us to understand the tragedies faced by individuals the world over. Our minds may help us to make some kind of sense of the suffering that we see. For instance, our minds may grapple with concepts such as karma and dharma as we try to conceive of a creator, a universe that allows such suffering to exist. On the other hand, we read in the voice of the silence that the mind is the great slayer of the real and that we must slay the mind. As with many aspects of the ancient wisdom, we're faced with a paradox. We need the organizational and structural components of our minds in order to begin to grasp metaphysical concepts. Yet our minds limit our ability to understand anything beyond the physical. Hugh Sherman, a well-known theosophical writer, says, "What we are asked to abandon is the illusion that that level of capacity, the mind, constitutes the self in us, that we're not simply the mind. We are more than the mind, but we can use the mind as a stepping stool and transcend it. It is through our minds that we begin to reach for ultimate understanding, to move toward our journey's end, not simply to know, but rather to know," in capital letters. However, we clearly can't get there through our mind alone. So, as Maida pointed out earlier, we study to expand the mind. But as we act, as we reflect, as we meditate, we begin to transcend the mind. As such, our actions and our meditations are essential components of this journey. Our actions, our love, our hearts reach out to those who are suffering. We see sadness and we act to comfort. We see intolerance and we work to mitigate it. We see poverty and hunger and we work to end it. Through this karma yoga, we move toward our journey's end, not simply to love all of creation, but rather to serve all aspects of life in the most divine sense. However, in order to avoid being swept up in the emotions of seeing the pain of humanity, of being swept up in the emotions of serving, our minds must accompany us on our journey. Our minds and our hearts must meld in order to provide the balance needed to both know and serve. Knowledge without service is useless. Service without knowledge is helpless. So how do we move forward? Using our studies to provide the basis of knowledge from which we serve is essential. If we didn't have some tentative understanding of the laws of karma, we would likely be overwhelmed with the heartache that exists in our world. At that point, we may simply give up in despair. Thus, instead of helping, we would be adding to the desperation that exists in so many places. Through our studies, we know that thoughts have power and can influence others. We can use our thoughts to help others. Also, through our studies, we know that meditation can help to raise the consciousness of humanity as a whole. Through understanding the divine wisdom, we can enhance our service. And serve, we must. The axiom, theosophy is who theosophy does, propels us towards service. We must do theosophy. We must put the teachings of theosophy into action. For some, the idea of putting theosophy into action may sound daunting. For others, the idea of putting theosophy into action is like the sound of a clarion call. For those of us who are daunted, we may wonder, how can I serve? What can I do? I mean, I don't have much money. I have to work. I have to take care of my family. What can I do? How can I serve? Regardless of whether we are racing to the forefront to challenge the inequities we see in society, or we're helping our neighbor during a time of need. We are doing theosophy. Each of us is unique and can serve in our own unique manner, and we do. We do. We can use our thoughts to help others, sending kind and caring thoughts to someone who is clearly having an especially difficult day. Someone cuts us off in traffic, you know, this old example. We can send thoughts of peace and caring instead of the thoughts that we're probably sending to them. We can use our actions to help others. Living our lives through random acts of kindness is truly a means of serving on a very simple level. We can hold the door open for someone, whether they need us to or not. We can make eye contact and smile genuinely at people that we see. How often does that happen? Of course, we can add to these simple methods of serving by focusing our thoughts and actions on a broader scale. Meditation. We can use our meditation practices to help raise the consciousness of humanity, to raise it above the mire of suffering and hurt so that all beings can live in the light. But let's be specific about serving in our day-to-day lives. That's where we are. That's what we can do. So there are two areas, I think, that we could look at tonight. One is non-judgmental acceptance of others. And the other, boundaries. We've talked about the unity of all beings as the crux of the theosophical life. When we look deeply at this statement, we realize that when we judge others, we're judging ourselves. And we're judging the divine. Of course, nobody here, I'm sure, is judgmental. Thoughts of, she's wearing that, don't cross our minds. And maybe they don't. Maybe they don't. Maybe we're not that superficial. But it may be that our judgments lie closer to, oh, I don't want to sit next to Tim. Do you know what he believes? Yeah, I don't want to do that. Or I may be very gracious, and I may say, today, I'm going to sit next to Tim. It's a shame he believes what he believes, but maybe one day he'll see the light. Either way, it's judgmental, isn't it? It really is. So how do we become non-judgmental? Well, thank goodness we have more than one incarnation, because I'm not sure that anybody can do it too quickly. Certainly, I can't. There are probably as many ways to do this as there are people in the world, because we're all unique. We're all on our own journey. From my perspective, it's useful to look at ourselves deeply and truthfully. How difficult. The first step, again for me, is first of all to be willing to do the hard work of moving toward non-judgmentalness. I have to be willing to do that before anything can happen. And then I have to look at myself. Find out what I'm really thinking and feeling, and then examine those thoughts and feelings in an objective manner. From there, moving from examination into observation of those thoughts and feelings. If my thought is, I don't want to sit next to Pablo in the class, because I know he's going to talk to me during the class, and I'm going to be so embarrassed. So I really don't want to sit by Pablo. What's really going on? What's really going on? If I stop and look at that and I pull that out objectively, and it's so hard, and I'd say probably impossible to really look at ourselves objectively, but to look at myself as objectively as I possibly can, when I pull out those thoughts and feelings, when I become consciously self-aware, which is one of the first steps, if not the first step on the road to spiritual development, I can begin to examine them in an objective way. This is tough. This is really tough. It's especially difficult because it has me looking at myself in a not very complimentary way. And trust me, it's not very complimentary. Although I would sit by Pablo anytime. Just clarify that. What I come up with is primarily selfishness. Selfishness, concern about myself, attachment, being concerned about what other people might think about me. And then I ice that with annoyance. When I observe these thoughts and feelings from a more universal perspective, then I gain more insight. If I truly believe that we are all one, and I mean believe, not just espouse, then I'm separating myself, both through my selfishness and my attachment to being thought of in a certain way. The exact opposite of what I say I'm trying to attain, unity. If I believe that we all make conscious choices about our lives, our personalities, our struggles, then if I'm going to be honest with myself, I must accept that Pablo is on his own journey, including talking during a class, and it has nothing to do with me. Furthermore, when I coat my thoughts and feelings with annoyance, that annoyance radiates out to anyone else in the room who might have feelings of annoyance from driving, from fixing dinner, whatever, and joins with those feelings of annoyance, and they continue on out into the world, joining with other feelings of annoyance ad infinitum. So my job then is to be supportive of everyone else on their journey, not judgmental about their journey, and to focus on feelings of acceptance and love. What would it be like, I wonder, to limit judgmentalness in my life? What would it be like to look at others as sparks of the divine and honor that in them instead of judge them? What an incredible service to humanity. One of my favorite quotes, one of my favorite theosophical quotes is from Voice of the Silence, which was translated and annotated by H.P.B. Let thy soul lend its ear to every cry of pain, like as the lotus bears its heart to drink the morning sun. Let not the fierce sun dry one tear of pain before thyself has wiped it from the sufferer's eye. But let each burning tear drop on thy heart and there remain, nor ever brush it off until the pain that caused it is removed. Many of us, I believe, can relate to this quote. We strive to ameliorate the suffering in the world. We feel called upon to help others, especially those others with whom we come into close contact. We see a friend who's struggling with grief over the death of a loved one. We see a homeless person pushing a buggy down the sidewalk. What do we do? Given this quote from the Voice of the Silence, what are we called upon to do? Should I reassure my friend and say, I know you're sad, but it's going to be okay. You'll be born again together one day. Do I give the homeless person half of my money, three quarters, all of it? I mean, we are one, right? What should I do? What do I do? Well, clearly we've wandered into the topic of boundaries. A boundary can be defined as a line that marks the limits of an area, a dividing line, a limiting of a subject or sphere of activity. There's my line. Not going past my boundary. So when we're talking about boundaries, does that mean that I stay inside of my boundary and I don't reach out to help anybody there? Well, according to many writings in the ancient wisdom, all of us are on what Clara Codd says is the immortal journey of the human spirit, out from the divine pleroma as an unconscious, nascent possibility, to return a fully conscious, fully developed son or daughter of God. Each one of us is on that journey. We began as unconscious possibility. We continue filled with the illusion of separateness. And eventually, we'll move nearer toward our goal, toward self-conscious awareness of our own divinity and the unity of all beings. Our journeys are unique and individual, while paradoxically, of course, our journeys are universal in nature, in that we share a common goal that links us all. We are all travelers on the path to self-conscious awareness, eventually coming to our end, to our journey's end, as fully conscious, fully developed aspects of the one life. On the website of the TS, when it discusses reincarnation, it says, "Reincarnation comes, then, as an opportunity for each of us to travel the way according to our own uniqueness. It is less a set number of lives than a series of opportunities for the realization of our spiritual goal. It is the technique life uses for the gaining of experience, for the self in learning how to live. In understanding it, we learn not to identify ourselves with the mode of travel, nor even with the traveling, but with that immortal spirit that has chosen to tread the path of life. Reincarnation comes then as a certainty of future achievements and a challenge of present actions." So what does this have to do with boundaries? Well, everything, really. Based on that, if I chose this incarnation, if I chose these lessons, these opportunities, the experiences for this lifetime that are going to facilitate my journey, that's what they're here for. That's why I chose them, or whatever, chose the possibility that they may occur. According to the ancient wisdom, going into incarnation, I recognize some of the difficulties that I am likely to face to survive and to conquer. So to a great extent, I have chosen my circumstances. Does this mean that a person has chosen to be homeless, and that that person should simply be patted on the head and said, "Well, you chose it, you know"? Or do I say to the person who's grieving for a loved one, "Well, you knew they were going to die, you know? You're supposed to learn something from this." Absolutely not. Not only are these statements condescending and cruel, they're also foolish. They're foolish. I have no clue, and I probably never will, in this life or any other, of what circumstances another person has chosen, what difficulties, what obstacles, what opportunities they are working toward. What I do know, what I do believe, is that other people are on this same journey. Different than mine, maybe, but also very similar to mine. Can I reach out a hand, figuratively or literally, to help someone else? Absolutely. Probably very much like you, there have been many people who have reached out a hand to me during my journey, helped me over some of those particularly difficult spots on the path. So going along with this is the importance of recognizing that this other person who may be struggling is as capable of overcoming this obstacle and reaching their goal as anyone else. So in addition to the helping hand, I can provide the helping thoughts. I know you can do this. Let's do this together. As opposed to, "Poor guy, you're never going to make it." But let's be specific. Let's be specific, because this is not easy. It's, again, paradoxical. When we look around and see someone suffering, someone we love especially suffering, struggling with the difficulties of life, our immediate tendency, or certainly my immediate tendency, is to want to take away the pain, to relieve the suffering. But it's important to look at this a little bit more closely. Think of your own lives. When have you learned the most? When have you found out what you're capable of doing? When have you had to reach above and beyond to survive a difficult time? For me, it was the most difficult times in my life. That's when I've learned the most. That's when I've grown the most. That's when I've had to stretch to see what I could do, what I could accomplish, to look above and beyond and to grow. Now, let me be clear. I don't want to relive those times. They were not fun, okay? But I don't wish them away because those are the times that have helped me to grow. Those are the times that have helped me to become who I am. And the times in the future will help me to become who I'm going to be. I have plenty of learning and growing left to do. There are plenty of obstacles ahead. I try not to think about them too much. But I know that if and when I reach those obstacles, they are there to help me on my journey. If I reach out to someone else who is suffering and I try to take away their pain, what am I really doing? What am I really doing? Am I implying to that person that they're not capable of surmounting this obstacle? Am I taking away their opportunity for growth? Well, that's assuming that I actually could take away their pain, which I can't. Think about it for a second. 5-year-old wants to make his own breakfast. Gets out a bowl, gets out the cereal, pours the cereal in the bowl, goes to the refrigerator and gets a full gallon of milk and heads for the cereal. We all know it's going to happen. So what do I do? Or what can I do? What can I choose to do? Probably rush toward that child and say, "You're going to spill it. Here, let me do that for you." And what have I implied? He's incapable. I've taken away the opportunity to learn how to pour milk. What I can do is say, "Here, let me help you." Not implying inability, not taking away that opportunity, but holding out a hand to help that 5-year-old learn. These are boundaries. These are boundaries. Limiting our sphere of activity. Not taking responsibility for another's challenges, another's growth, but offering a hand, offering to walk the path a while with someone else. The Buddha taught that the first noble truth is suffering. All who live suffer in some way. And I'm sure most of us can attest to that from our own lives and from the lives of people around us. Certainly, all we have to do is watch the evening news to believe that. Why do we suffer? Well, that's why we study, isn't it? According to the ancient wisdom, we suffer because we believe this life is reality. Because we're attached to things, to people, to ideas. That is, we desire. We desire. So how do we eliminate suffering? Well, I wish it was as easy as the words, because we could just do it like that. The recognition that there is a reality greater than the one that we see, the one in which we live. By working to extinguish the attachment, to extinguish the desire. You can have my house, you can have my furniture, all of that. Please don't take away my theosophical ideas because I really need those. I am working so hard, as are you, to extinguish that desire, those attachments inside of me. How in the world do I think I can possibly take them away from somebody else? Oh my gosh. And really, if I could, would I do that? Would I take away their opportunity to learn and grow? No, no. Because while I might not like my neighbor, I definitely love humanity. And that was a joke, y'all. Okay. My sister's my neighbor. I do like her. I just didn't want y'all to fall all the way asleep. You know, I don't want to take that opportunity away because I want us all on this journey. I want us all a want. I think that's a desire. Yikes, lots of work to do. Okay. Headed to that final journey. So, while I can recognize that pain and suffering exist, can't take it away, I can only stay in my own sphere of activity, I can reach out a hand and help that person on their journey and also walk my own path. When you think about it, if we combine non-judgmentalness or working towards non-judgmentalness, and we combine this thought about boundaries and helping others without trying to take on their suffering, without trying to take away their opportunities, what an incredible service on a daily basis that would be. So when we look at our world today and we see the suffering, what we can also see are the endless possibilities for service. Serving through the use of non-judgmentalness and setting boundaries. Service through study, action, and meditation. Service through the use of both our heads and our hearts. Using both our heads and our hearts, keeping ourselves balanced, and helping to balance the world in which we live. With our minds, we use our minds to begin to grasp those concepts that will help us to understand the meaning of life. With our hearts, we reach out to others on the journey. It is through study, service, and meditation, the focus of the last two objects of our society, that we come to a more thorough, a more complete understanding of the first object of our society, the creation or the recognition of universal brotherhood. Difficult tasks, but not insurmountable. We know from our studies that we will achieve our goal. We will get there. HPB wrote a poem entitled, "There is a Road," and it reminds us of this. She writes, "There is a road, steep and thorny, beset with perils of every kind, but yet a road, and it leads to the very heart of the universe. I can tell you how to find those who will show you the secret gateway that opens inward only and closes fast behind the neophyte forevermore. There is no danger that dauntless courage cannot conquer. There is no trial that spotless purity cannot pass through. There is no difficulty that strong intellect cannot surmount. For those who win onward, there is reward past all telling, the power to bless and to save humanity. For those who fail, there are other lives in which success will come." Keeping those words in mind, let us reach out our hands to our brothers and sisters, to those who are suffering, so that we can walk this steep and thorny road together. Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
You wanted to take some questions?
Yeah, I have no answers, but sure. Maybe somebody else does.
I didn't neglect to mention, I deliberately did not mention that Barbara is also PhD and the director of the University Counseling Center at Southeastern Louisiana University. So I didn't want to awe you too much before she spoke. Do we have some questions?
I was just really struck by the idea how you talked about non-judgmental and boundaries and how they really need to be done together, but are so challenging to do. Because I think of that person you say that you don't want to sit next to who's talking during meetings, and I think, yes, I set a boundary for myself. I know there's certain people in my life that are not good for me to be around. Mm-hmm. But how do I set that boundary without being judgmental on them to say, you're not a good person for me, but I still wish you well? Mm-hmm. Or to even go that step further to say, you're in my path to challenge me for a reason, and I need to accept you and love that. That's really, really hard.
It's so hard. I wish this was all much easier. And I wish I really had a very clear answer for you. And that's one of the things, in all honesty, that makes me uncomfortable about talking, because it implies that I have answers, and I have none. I'm a searcher, just like everyone else. But non-judgmentalness and boundaries are two things that I talk to my clients about a great deal. I think that's why I love being a counselor, because it's so very theosophical in nature. You know, I think for me, which is the only way I can come at this, for me, sometimes there are people in my path that push my buttons. And those are people that I have to work with every day, every day. We're not webcast, are we? Okay. Thought I should clarify that. Maybe so. Although the person I'm speaking of would not be watching this. And it's not just one, obviously. There are many, many. And so I think part of that, the way that I get through my days when my buttons are particularly are being pushed, is to first take a breath and to step back. Because my personality just gets so caught up in it so quickly. So when I take a breath and sort of mentally step back and think about it for a second, from a more universal perspective, then I stop and think, you know, I really don't know where she's coming from. But I do believe in my heart that she's trying the best that she can. And so while I can recognize, so let me be a little bit more specific. I can recognize that this person gets other people to help her do her work by looking helpless, which drives me crazy. Sorry, it's that feminist in me. I can't stand it. And so I recognize that. That's where she is. It's just where she is. She probably looks at me and thinks, you know, Barbara's got a few issues she really needs to work through. She's pretty bossy. You know, and it's true, I probably am. But to see that in her, not be angry with her for that, but just to accept that's where she is. Deal with it appropriately. You know, I don't give in, I don't rescue her, I don't save her. But just to see where she is and sort of let it go. Does that sort of make sense? I keep my boundaries.
It's hard to willingly accept and seek out those people in your life to say, you are here in my life for a reason, and I need to have this compassion towards you. It's going that extra step. Mm-hmm. I can have the boundary and not get involved, but going that extra step to say, I love you for those flaws that you have. Mm-hmm. That's the really tricky part, I think, that theosophy helps us with.
It is so hard, isn't it? Yeah. Wouldn't it? To me, it would be so wonderful to be able to do that on a daily basis. And I'd have to work so hard to do it on the few occasions when I do manage it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I sat through our last TS meeting saying, you're learning acceptance, you're learning acceptance, you're learning acceptance, just breathe. And it worked. And by the end of the meeting, things were beautiful. It was wonderful. And I thought, what was I worried about? It was great. But really, it's that constant work, and that's, I think, why we get to have so many incarnations, because it is such hard work.
Along that same line, I just thought, you talk about being judgmental and boundaries. What would be your advice for, you know, you look around in the world, and there are people who are actively harming others. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what they do. Mm-hmm. And so how would you approach? I mean, what would your recommendations be for dealing with that sort of person in the world or in your life?
Well, there are two things. One is, as a counselor, I never give advice because that's taking responsibility for the other person's actions. And I, you know, in a theosophical sense, I don't want their karma, so I don't give advice. But that's true, but I'm sort of picking. When you were talking about that, it made me think about work. As Tim mentioned, I'm a counselor. And my love, my passion is to work with children. I'm a registered play therapist, and as well as working at a university counseling center. But I do a lot of work with children. I do a lot of work with children who've been sexually abused. I think that's sort of maybe what you're talking about, people who purposely hurt children. Innocent children. And so I think one of the ways that I personally deal with that is, again, to breathe, and to let go as much as I can of my own anger and frustration, and to recognize that for some person to hurt another person purposely, consciously, this person must have been hurt in some way. I believe that evil exists in the world, but I don't think very many people actually purposely go out to do evil. There are probably some, but the greatest majority of people don't. And when they, in my opinion, so when somebody hurts somebody else, it's usually because they can't control themselves, maybe. They don't recognize what they're doing. They are so hurt that they can't figure out, that's my southern language, they can't determine any other way to react. And so when it comes back, when I think about that and when I start getting frustrated, then I start thinking about karma. And I think, okay. And this is probably not that non-judgmental acceptance. It's probably something that just makes me feel better. It's like, okay, well, you know what? This person is going to learn somehow, sometime, somewhere, that this is not okay. Now, I'm going to do everything I can to stop it right now. But if I can't, and frequently I can't, then I know that it's going to happen. That allows me to step back and recognize that for whatever reason, these individuals have chosen this path. They've chosen this path. I'm thinking specifically of a little girl that I've been working with for a little over 2 years. She's 4 years old right now, just turned four. So I've been working with her since before she was two, just before she was two. It took her about 2 years, but she finally disclosed sexual abuse. It was investigated, lots of commotion and anyway, bottom line is, I got a text message from the mom 2 days ago saying that the judge had given the alleged perpetrator 4 hours of visitation a week with this child. And I looked at it. I looked at my phone. I have to tell you, I didn't throw it because I'm going to break my phone, but I put it down hard and I said, I hate the court and I hate those stupid judges. And I walked out of the room. Then I started to breathe again, okay, because that is my personal reaction. I thought, okay, well, you know, whatever. This child has chosen, if I really believe, this child has chosen this, maybe not purposely to be abused, but knowing that that possibility was going to occur. And I believe that this child, as a spark of the divine, has the strength and the resiliency to get through this. And if it occurs again, she's going to tell again, you know, and we'll go through the process again. But she has the strength to get through this, and she's got something to work out with the alleged perpetrator, her mom, whoever. And that's what keeps me going. I think it's probably my theosophical beliefs that allow me to work with these kids without losing my mind and going and hurting somebody else. Does that sort of answer what you were talking about? Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate it.